Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This interview is brought to you by Cambridge University Press. Please visit Cambridge at www.cambridge.org. There you can find their entire catalog of books. And of course, you can buy them there as well. So please visit the press today. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network. And each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. This interview is brought to you by Cambridge University Press. Please visit Cambridge at www.cambridge.org. There you can find their entire catalog of books. And, of course, you can buy them there as well. So please visit the press today. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network. And each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books, and we interview the authors of those books. This week I really happened upon a very, very interesting book by Benjamin Radcliffe, and we have him today on the show, called The Political Economy of Human Happiness, How Voters' Choices Determine the Quality of Life. I had never read a book of this type that is as rigorous as this one, and that's something I really liked about it. Ben does not shy away from showing us what he learned, and again, show your work is an important thing in a presentation such as this, particularly important in his presentation, because he has something I would say is relatively controversial to say. It's not as controversial once you look at the data, which is good. So he doesn't have to bear the weight of it; the data does. But still, as we will say in the context of the interview or in the course of the interview, there is a punchline here, and it's a really interesting one. So Ben, thank you for writing the book, and thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself to kick things off?
Sure. I'm a professor of political science. I teach at the University of Notre Dame, where I've spent most of my academic career. I've been there since 1991. Right now, I'm on a Fulbright Fellowship in the Netherlands at an institute called the Roosevelt Study Center. My early work was very conventional, mainstream behavioral political science, the kind of thing I was trained to do in graduate school that appears in mainstream journals and so on elections and public policy and participation and democratic theory and so on. A dozen or so years ago, I shifted gears a bit and turned towards what was at that time a very strange endeavor, which was the social scientific study of human happiness. You know, a decade and more on, that's become a very mainstream, very huge, multidisciplinary research program that everyone is, now interested in. So I feel sort of vindicated in having made that, at the time, risky choice. As a political scientist, my work naturally focuses within that context on the connections between political outcomes and human happiness, and then the sort of obvious political outcomes that are the most important are public policies, the things that governments do. Hence the title of the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. Human happiness is now, it's a big thing. It's a big and controversial thing, big and controversial subject. Let me ask you this. Why did you decide to write this book?
You know, there's a bunch of reasons. Some of them are sort of small and personal and professional. In part, I'd followed the model, as I alluded to a moment ago, of doing what they told me to do in graduate school, which is, you know, which is to sit in my office and in the scholarly gnome-like way, crunch out article after article for mainstream professional political science journals which I think have value and that are, you know, designed to be scientific in the narrow sense of accumulating political science knowledge within highly narrow literatures designed to be read only by another 100 people within that particular area. Having done that for, a while, I wanted to do something else. I wanted to do something that was both a little more, had a little more room for creativity, a little more room for personal expression. More importantly, and this is the real reason for doing the book, the intellectual reason, is that I wanted in some small way to try to make a difference. I wanted to try, to the extent that scholarship can actually make any kind of contribution to the world, I wanted to try to write about something that I thought was of genuine importance and to write in a way that I hoped would be accessible to a general audience, as opposed, again, to academics. So in the choice of topic, the work on happiness seemed obvious, not only because it's what I had been working on for a decade, but in writing a bunch of these narrow peer-reviewed articles that I mentioned about, but also because it seemed to me that this was touching on what is arguably the single most important and persistent question that we face in modern democratic politics, which is, you know, if we want to make the world a better place, if we want to make a world in which more people live happier and more fulfilling and rewarding lives, what kind of public policy regimes do we actually want to create? Fundamentally, you know, there are only really two options available at the grandest level. Those are the political program of the left or the political program of the right. And so, you know, I wanted to the extent one can, to take what seems like a philosophical or ideological question, is left or right policies, which are better, to try to extract from that an empirical question, a question that we can actually answer with data using the same canons of evidence and proof and so on that we would use in answering any other empirical question. The purpose of the book then is to try to apply the methods and the protocols of reliability and validity of data and just the general whole way in which we do social science to this question of what it is that makes the world a better place, insofar as we think of a happier world as a better world. So again, that was the impetus for the book, was to try to sit back and to try to make a comment as a scholar, as opposed to as a partisan or an ideologue, about a path towards by which human beings might build a happier world.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to interrupt you there when you said try to make a difference and write for a popular audience, and the thought that occurred to me is, that's just weird for an academic to do. Did they fire you? I mean, what happened?
Well, not yet. We'll have to see. Yeah,
that's a brave thing to do. I encourage other people to do it as well. So let's get into the meat of the book. As you say, it's it's about public policy in the broadest sense, and it's about the rights agenda program and the less agenda program, as is defined mostly in the Western world. I don't know much about the non-Western world. So the big question, obviously, and I don't want to get stuck on it because we could, because these discussions about happiness become word salad pretty fast. How do you measure human happiness?
Well, we inevitably, in large-scale studies, end up using survey data. That is, so you've essentially just asked people one or more different types of survey questions, which try to tap the extent to which they find life to be rewarding. There's a little cottage industry that's developed among scholars over really the last 30 years or even longer of trying to find what the exact best questions are and to test their statistical properties and their conceptual validity, to make sure that we can actually do this. Right? It does seem on its face to some people, I think, a little odd to reduce something like happiness to a survey question. Um, but that's what we do. And I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest, and I can talk about some of that evidence if you want, that this is a sensible thing to do. The short version is the most asked question is about life satisfaction. And the question is something very much like this. You ask something like, all things considered, or all things taken together, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole these days? Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So you're asking people to think about their life as a totality, not just today or this minute, but the totality of their life in general. How satisfied are you with that life? Mm-hmm. And ask them to rate that on a scale from 1 to 10. Mm-hmm. And there are other variants. You can ask people to imagine the best possible life and the worst possible life, to compare their life to that. You can simply ask them how happy they are. A bunch of other ways of asking the same question. And one of the ways in which we think that the questions make sense is that the answers all correlate very highly. So you ask someone how satisfied they are, you get the same kind of answers that you get if you ask them about the best versus worst possible life, or how happy they are, or again, some other possible variants of asking the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm reminded of the false dichotomy, is it better to be a happy pig or Socrates? And obviously it's better to be a happy Socrates, right? That's not really complicated,
no.
Is it?
Yeah, no, indeed. So, that would be the ideal.
I guess just to throw in my own two cents for no reason other than I want to do it, is that it seems to me intuitively obvious that people know they're happy when they know they're happy. You know, it's just an intuition you have. Yes, I'm happy. Or just like you know something is wrong, or you know something is beautiful. You really do know it. You know it, but you know it.
And it's odd. Right at the moment you were saying that, I was scribbling down to myself, people know how happy they are. Yeah. And then that's one of the when push comes to shove in this discussion about whether we can measure happiness using survey data, a lot of it comes down to whether people actually know whether they're happy or not. And then there's a lot of people who think that they don't, right? people are too foolish to know how happy they are. But I think I agree emphatically with you that people do know how happy they are.
I think they do. I don't think there's any question they do. But they have this sort of intuitive feeling. It's very difficult to quantify, actually, but it is there. And there are lots of things like that in life that are there. Aesthetic judgment is one of them. Moral judgment is another. They exist, and you have a feeling about them. But they're very hard to they're a little bit hard to measure, but we know they're there. So anyway, let's get past that. So let's just say, yes, you can, in fact, we know this thing exists, happiness. We know people can recognize it and we can measure it. So in setting up the question, left or right policies, what factors did you take into account?
Well, if I'm following you on the question, it's a question of articulating what left versus right policies actually mean.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, so I set them up in two basic categories. One relates to the general size of government, which in turn is broken down into two categories, which how best to describe this. The one part is within the size of government is the state's effort at the provision of public welfare, income maintenance programs, pensions, health care, all the kinds of services that we want the government to provide, and that that are really directly sent to individuals. And the second is a more general, vague, the overall size of government, the footprint of government as measured, say, by the percentage of taxes the government collects out of the economy. And mm-hmm. So you can imagine that the government is bigger the larger the share of the economy that it consumes mm-hmm. or controls through taxation. So that you can think of a socialistic economy as being one in which the entire economy is politically, which is to say democratically, allocated. Mm-hmm. Right. So those two ideas on the size of government, the direct efforts at government to provide for people who can't provide for themselves, what mm-hmm. we call welfare, and then the general overall footprint of the government in the economy. Mm-hmm. The other side of the coin is in the labor market, where I'm looking at labor market rules and regulations that affect, say, the minimum wage, things that affect how workers relate to employers. And similarly, as part of this general rubric, the power of or the strength of the of organized labor as representatives of working people.
Mm-hmm. And so it's labor and rules.
Right.
And then don't you also talk about the percentage of people in unions and things like this? Like, can I remember?
Yeah. Exactly. So that's one of the – so, yes, I'm looking at on the labor side, there's the two – empirically, we look at a couple of different measures of the amount of economic regulation of the labor market. And then we also look at whether individuals mm-hmm. belong to labor unions, and then more importantly, the overall level of what we call labor union density, meaning the percentage of workers who belong to unions within the country.
Mm-hmm. So then – The general plan of the study is to survey people across various cohorts, and these are political cohorts, say U.S. states or foreign countries or countries
right.
in general, and then see how well or poorly these metrics, that is the one being just generally sort of size of government and the other one sort of labor policy, how well or poorly they correlate with happiness. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, exactly. A slight elaboration of that would be, which it just extends the logic, is we create statistical models where we have something that we normally call the dependent variable, the thing that we're trying to explain,
right.
which in this case is happiness. And then we just create statistical models which measure the impact of the political variables, the independent variables like the size of the state or the importance of the labor union density on happiness, while taking into account all the other things that we believe affect happiness. And then
mm-hmm.
we call those the control variables. So we find, say, greater welfare spending causes greater levels of happiness, controlling for all the other stuff which is thought to affect happiness, so as to isolate the effects of welfare spending on happiness.
Right.
And so we're not talking about simple correlations. We're talking about pretty elaborate econometric models, which try to, as best we can, to isolate the impact of the political factors on happiness, and to eliminate alternate explanations, so that we're as confident as we can be that we found a causal relationship as opposed to merely a correlation.
Right. So I don't remember this terminology very well, but you're trying to extract confounding variables. Is that right?
Yeah.
So just to give an example, so people will understand, you have a country and you notice that there's a really strong correlation between the size of the government and happiness. But then you also find out that that country is heavily Catholic. And we know that Catholicism mm-hmm. also correlates heavily internationally with happiness. So then you need to parse that out.
Yeah, exactly. And Catholicism may also correlate with size of government, right? Yeah, exactly. So you're trying to separate out the effect of a Catholic political culture, say, the size of government per se, to make sure that what you're not picking up is some kind of residual effect of Catholicism that is being expressed through econometrically through a variable that reflects the size of the state.
And you can do that because you have lots of observations. That is, there are lots
yes.
of countries and there are lots of U.S. states.
Yes.
So you see lots of variety, so you can actually control for the variables.
Yeah.
If you only had two, you'd be in trouble.
Yes. That would be much more difficult.
Yeah, that would be very bad. That would be very bad for the study. So I think we understand it now, exactly what we're doing. And so let's move on to the most interesting part of the book, and that is what you found. And we can begin with these variables about size of government, that is the public degree of public welfare spending, I guess, and the footprint of the government in terms of the percent of the tax base which is taken up by the government.
Right. Well, basically, you find very consistent relationships. So in the chapter in the book that discusses the size of the state, I think there are seven different empirical indicators that reflect the two dimensions that we just talked about. So there's, you know, in part to build the preponderance of evidence, you don't rely just on a single indicator of something complicated, difficult to measure. You come up with one or two or three different measures of every different concept. So, you know, we've got seven variables representing these two different concepts, measuring things in different ways. And the results are incredibly consistent and tell a very similar story. And that story is easily summarized, which is that the political program of the left, as suggested by greater welfare spending, greater total government spending, greater tax burden, just big government in general, uniformly across all of the models, controlling for every conceivable counter-explanation, has a positive and statistically significant impact on well-being, and on happiness, implying, in other words, that the big government, the welfare state, these things make the world a happier place, and in that limited sense, vindicate the progressive or social democratic approach to politics. Mm-hmm. And just to elaborate that just a little bit, what we see is that this relationship holds up in general, whether we analyze the data at the level of individuals, or we use as a unit of analysis, as we say, the national mean. So in other words, we can look at models where we have 58,000 people across 20 countries, or we can look at models where we have just 20 countries using average happiness, and you get the exact same results. You also get the exact same results when you start breaking down the population into subgroups. So for instance, the positive effect of the welfare state on happiness is about the same for low as high income people, a little bit more for low income, but not a lot, not nearly as much as one might expect. And also the differences between men and women are very small. Differences between almost any subgroup are small or non-existent. The main takeaway point that I find here is to reiterate a point made by Thomas Paine, among many other people, which is an egalitarian society, a society which takes care of the working class and the poor, which tries to eliminate as much as possible inequality and so on, produces a world in which everyone is better off. Mm-hmm. So in other words, we're not doing Robin Hood. We're not, right. At least in happiness, we're not redistributing happiness. We may be redistributing money, but we're not redistributing happiness. We're not taking away from some people to give to others.
Right. So a couple of questions.
Please.
One of them is, how big is the effect overall?
Well, it varies a little bit by variable to variable and model to model, and then it's difficult to express in absolute terms, because happiness, of course, isn't something like dollars where I could give you a dollar amount. But the typical way we would compare things is by using a benchmark. So in other words, you'd say that the impact of, say, being unemployed on happiness is usually considered the most powerful thing that makes someone unhappy, being unemployed. Mm-hmm. Or being married, getting married, which is considered to be one of the strongest positive impacts in the opposite direction, of course.
I want to make a joke about that, but I'm not
going to. Yeah, the possibility for jokes is too broad. We have to declare a truce there and go on. Mm-hmm. But so if you use those as benchmarks, the difference in the political factors is enormous. It dwarfs those by orders of magnitude. So in other words, the difference between, imagine the difference in the quality of someone's life of, finding love, of being married, of having a good marriage. That enormous improvement in their quality of life, or the quality improvement of your life that comes from ending a period of long-term unemployment, those things are much smaller than the differences between living in the most social democratic country, say Sweden or Denmark, and the least social democratic countries.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. So it's a large effect.
It's a massive effect.
Yeah, compared to ordinary life events, which we think of as making you happy and unhappy. This is a massive.
Yeah, exactly. And if I could, just to press that point just a little bit, it's the primacy of politics is what strikes me here is personally so telling, which is that we think of happiness primarily as something that is an individual level phenomenon. That sure, the background of the society in which you live and events that are taking place are going to affect you. But presuming you live in a stable, relatively prosperous country, not dealing with a war or an economic depression, if in ordinary times, we would think of the sort of background of life as being being comparatively unimportant to the individual level stuff going on in your day-to-day life. The research seems to suggest that, you know, the political conditions shape your day-to-day life in subtle ways that, that are not so immediately apparent, and you know, that the structure of society as determined by public policies, you know, affect people's lives in these kind of insidious ways, if I can use that word, in these subtle and complex ways.
Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating, actually. I would not have expected that. I really would not have. That is counterintuitive. Did you expect that?
I didn't expect the degree of the effect. No, the magnitudes are startling even to me.
Yeah. So another couple of questions about just that size of government variable. I'd like to hear about outliers. Are there places in which there are really big governments and really unhappy people, and then really small governments and really happy people?
Yeah, one of the things I'm always at pains to do in the book is to deal with objections or counterarguments and so on. There's a section in an appendix to one of the chapters which I talks about two countries, I think Ireland and Switzerland, which on paper are superficially seem to break the pattern. In other words, they're both countries with modest sized welfare states and so on, but are on much happier than you might expect them to be. Mm-hmm. Given that the analysis goes through and talks about why some of those reasons are, the short version is I don't think that they actually emerge as outliers when you take into account all of the situations, and particularly if you look at what happened to those countries when they are changing their welfare systems. Mm-hmm. So
and then sad people with big governments. I mean, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. I used to live there, so I can tell you that I've been one of them.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's another good point. I'm purposely limiting my analysis to the industrial democracies of Western Europe, North America, the Pacific, as a methodological strategy, precisely to avoid applying the argument to countries to which it doesn't apply.
Right. You want to, fair, and that's fair. You want to compare likes with likes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the whole key to the argument is that the government isn't just big, but the government is responsible to citizens, that it's a real democracy.
Yeah, the Soviet government was not responsible to its citizens.
No, to say the least.
So that should not be included in your comparison.
Right. Exactly.
You know, Cambodia under Pol Pot. No, I don't think we're going to include them.
No, I certainly hope not.
Yeah. So anyway, let's move on to the second big set of variables, and that's about labor, and this includes the degree of regulation. And then the sort of degree of participation in unions. And here we're talking about real regulation. And real unions, not the kind they had in the Soviet Union.
Right, exactly.
Right, so go ahead.
Yeah, well, so the analysis on regulation, I use two different variables. One is something created by the Fraser Institute, which, like the Heritage Foundation, is a conservative think tank, which, to its credit, produces a lot of very professional analysis and produces a lot of very professional data. One of the things that they produce is an index of what they call freedom in the world, economic freedom in the world, and they produce a bunch of indicators in that vein. I use their indicator of freedom in the labor market, meaning the absence of labor market regulations. I also use an indicator of something that the Europeans are very keen on called employment protection legislation, or EPL, which is a measure essentially of how easy it is to fire people, and the rules of what people are covered under those rules that make it difficult to fire people. The economic freedom thing is sort of complicated to discuss. I could go into the details, but the short version is that both of these indices measure the extent to which workers are protected in labor markets in sort of the ways that I think we intuitively understand what being protected by the government means. The Fraser Institute thing includes, for instance, things like the minimum wage and so on. So what you find for both of these indicators is basically the same results as before. The less economic freedom there is, meaning the more economic regulation, the happier people are, and the more employment protection legislation there is, the happier people are. And that again holds up when you break down things into high and low income people, men and women, and so on. So, I mean, that's, you don't need to, one doesn't need to spend a lot of time thinking about what those results mean. They're pretty transparent. You know, the more the democratic state intervenes in the relationship between workers and employers in ways that are consistent with the interests of workers, we seem to create situations in which just about everyone is happier. You know, and you can imagine why that would be. People tend to face, particularly working class people, as opposed to professionals, tend to face workers. Face their employers in a subordinate position, right? They're not able to make decisions about how work is organized, about safety in the workplace. They're certainly not able to make decisions about whether they're going to be fired or dismissed at any given time, about severance packages and all that kinds of things. To the extent you create laws which protect everyone as workers, it seems, the data would suggest, that we're moving towards creating a world in which, you know, people are happier. Mm-hmm. On the labor union side, the results are again fairly straightforward. I'm focusing again on two things. One is as an individual a member of a union, and the results suggest that, again, controlling for all other factors, people who belong to labor unions are happier than others. The magnitude of the relationship there is not enormous. It's not in the same order of magnitude as the other factors we discussed, but it's statistically significant. The main point that emerges is the importance of labor union density. Again, meaning the strength of the labor movement as measured by the percentage of people who belong to unions. So essentially what you find is that as labor union density increases, people are happier, and that this again applies not only to high and low income people, but also to people who belong to unions and people who don't. Right. So I'll say that again, just to be clear. Yeah, a strong labor movement. If you live in a country where, in Scandinavian countries, say, where 80% of workers may belong to a labor union, compared to a country like the United States, where, I don't know, 12% or so of people belong to unions. If you live in the high density country, the Scandinavian country, nearly everyone is going to be happier. Mm-hmm. Right? People who belong to unions and people who don't, rich people and poor people, men and women, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. So again, so the effects, you've talked about how strong the effect is, and it's pretty strong.
Yes. This effect is, again, the density effect is similar to the effects I described before. Okay. For the size of the state.
Right. And then do you find outliers again? Can you talk about any outliers? You said you mentioned Ireland and Switzerland last time.
Actually, I don't think there are statistically mm-hmm. any outliers within the analysis.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Well, that's what you found. That's what you found. That's the great thing about data.
Yeah.
That's what you found. You have a really interesting chapter on the American states. And the thing, I read it with these eyes, like, which state should I live in? So can you talk a little bit about which states sort of rate high on happiness and why, and if the whole model works within the American states?
Yeah, well, the short version is the model does work. I mean, I've replicated as much as I could the analysis from the prior chapters, which, is, as you pointed out, are across countries and across time, and instead shifted the unit of analysis here to looking across the American states. So we're essentially treating the American states as if they were countries and looking for the same kind of relationships. Mm-hmm. And generally, you know, you have to map, try to find equivalent indicators to the cross-national ones, which don't map perfectly. But I have four basic political variables, which I think are interesting. And the first is just welfare payments. The second is another measure of economic regulation, another one of these measures of so-called economic freedom. Those show exactly the same relationships as cross-nationally. More welfare spending means happier people. More economic regulation means happier people.
Mm-hmm.
And then two other variables which are unique to the United States. I looked at the ideology of governments. There's a measure of people come up with, you know, the government in Oregon in 1986 is put on a metric where it's, you know, its ideology is, you know, a given numeric value. And also the amount of Democratic Party control of state legislatures. So in essence, looking at the liberalism of state governments and also the party control of state governments. And what one finds is that states with a history of rule by liberal governments are happier, and states with a history of rule by the Democratic Party are happier. A recent history, meaning, you know, since 1970.
Mm-hmm. And that's also, I mean, we should say again that you considered other variables. And those
yes,
were,
so
those
all
were
of
accounted for.
Correct. So in all of these models that I've discussed, you always have a set of control variables where you're trying to, again, to control for all the other stuff that might affect well-being. So, you know, for instance, in the I'm looking at the book at one of the tables for looking at the effect of Democratic Party control on satisfaction with life. There's a set of control variables which include, I can just read some of them, one's income, one's satisfaction with one's income, one's education, whether one is unemployed, gender, the number of children one's have, a series of variables for demographic factors like race, age, whether one is widowed, divorced, married, how often they attend church, how much trust they have in other people, their individual health, and then a whole set of variables that try to control for the structure of the state in which they live, the racial diversity of the state population, state income, and so on. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to separate out all of these other things that could possibly be affecting happiness within a state besides the political factors that we're discussing.
Mm-hmm. I see. So that's an important thing. Yeah, I mean, you considered other things. I was thinking, like, you know, did you consider the average length of the day in winter? Because I have people in the northern part of the country.
I haven't myself, but other people have actually done. There's a small little set of research on climate and related things where you might think that people living in
February,
say, Southern California are happier than people in
Minnesota.
Iceland. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, okay, well, I just wondered.
Oddly.
About that. Yeah, because we do talk about it that way. We say, you know, I don't know if it's true or not, but we do. So this is all fascinating, and I think it is. I don't even know if this is a word, but I remember from philosophy class, dispositive. Is that a word? It means, like, I think you've shown this to be true. This is an actual thing.
I hope so.
Yes, I think that's right. But let me play a conservative for a moment. And not the Stephen Colbert dumb kind, but I think the Edmund Burke sort of smart kind. And I have a couple of different, you know, questions, which I think a conservative, somebody in the Republican Party who is a thinking person, would ask about this. And one of them has to do with happiness as a political goal. And I could sort of set it up like this. It may be the case that markets don't do everything we want them to. They do a good job, and you say this many times in the book, that they do a great job of spurring innovation. They do a great job of producing high levels of productivity and more or less the fair distribution of goods. You know, it's not perfect, but we don't know any better mechanism to do this, and we've tried. And you say that again and again in the book. I just have to say that. You know, you're not saying that we should go to the barricades and say all property is theft and nationalize stuff.
No, exactly. I'm a friend of the market economy.
Yes, right. You say that many times, and I think that's good. So let's just say, okay, that's right. This is the best way to do this. And you could actually use the state to increase – I'll just say this is true, me conservative, that you could use the state to actually raise the level of happiness. But you could only do so at the cost of the what is the word I'm looking for? At the cost of the comparative strength of the American economy in the future in the international context. Whether you think the American economy should be bridled or not is one thing. The international economy is never going to be. And if we don't really hit the market hard, that is to say, if we don't keep people innovating in this way, we're going to fall behind the Chinese and the Germans and everybody else, and we're going to suffer in the long term. So now is not the time to be spending our money on happiness. Now is the time to get to work.
Well, certainly an interesting argument, and frankly, a more intelligent one than I typically get as a critique of this work. I guess I would say that if the issue were one of a long-term investment to ensure long-term happiness for everyone versus short-term happiness fix.
Yeah, that's well stated, actually.
I think you were clear. Anyway, if that were the trade-off, then I think any rational person would have to be on the side of let's skip the short fix and go for the long run. I guess I'm not sure that there's any reason to think two things. One is I'm not sure there's any reason to think that there is that trade-off. The other is that I'm not sure how that trade-off could possibly be made in an economy that is completely unregulated or unplanned. In other words, if you leave the market entirely to itself, it's not going to do things like invent the internet.
Right.
That took the government to do.
Yep.
These kinds of massive long-term investments in a country's future take place in some kind of partnership between business and government and labor. They don't just occur spontaneously. And one of the faults in free market thinking, which is one of its advantages in other ways, is this idea that there's always a spontaneous order that the market will produce. And as you said, the market does a lot of things wonderfully, but it doesn't do coordination all that well.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the problem of the collective goods problem, externalities, all these kinds of things you learn in economics 101 that you actually need governments to solve.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if I could just I'm babbling, but just to return to the first point on whether such a trade-off is necessary, one of the things I'm at pains to do again in one of the appendices of the chapters is look at the arguments that investments in the welfare state or the size of government or even labor unions have deleterious long-term consequences on economic growth. I'm not really an economist. I'm sort of a consumer of that literature, although I do some econometric modeling of it. It seems to me that the evidence that government spending, say, reduces long-term economic performance is incredibly weak at best. If you look at what are the most prosperous countries in the world, there are places like Denmark and Sweden and Finland. And those places not only have giant welfare states, but they also have incredibly, they're incredibly pro-business places to be. They appear consistently in rankings like by Forbes and other places in the best countries in the world to do business. It's not like there's a trade-off between these things always.
Mm-hmm.
you can have a big welfare state and still have a highly vibrant and pro-business economy.
Yeah, well, I mean, that really is the empirical question. And I think that even me, the shadow conservative, would agree that's the thing that we need to find out about. We need to know the degree to which the kind of government spending which is necessary to produce a welfare state that makes happy people is a detriment to long-term economic growth. I don't know. I really don't. So
I don't think anybody really knows, but I'm pretty confident that the doom and gloom idea that the welfare state must produce these kinds of negative consequences
mm-hmm.
isn't true. Not only because of all kinds of data analysis done in peer-reviewed journals by very high-profile people who know what they're doing, but also just the visible, livable experience. If anyone's ever been to Western Europe, to Northern Europe in particular, you see the kind of world that we're talking about. It's not a fictional world we're trying to create. It's one that is tangible. It's here. It's there. It's both places with people where people are happier, where they live longer, and where they also have a better economy than we have. There isn't that trade-off.
Yeah, I mean, you can actually go see it. I encourage all listeners, probably have, but go see it. Go to France for a while. They live pretty well over there.
Yeah,
most
indeed.
Places they do pretty well.
Yeah,
that's not fiction.
Exactly.
I love America. It's my favorite place. But come on, it's pretty good over there. You know, people don't go to vacation to like Cleveland. I love Cleveland too. You know, go Browns. But they don't go to Cleveland for vacation. So that's a pragmatic counter argument that a conservative might make. I want to go to another counter argument that a conservative might make, and this one has to do with American political tradition, sort of who we are. I'm just speaking about Americans now, not other people. One of the striking things about your book was how hard I think you found it, and I may be wrong about this, to express what you were talking about in terms of liberal policy in a way that didn't just poison the argument from the beginning. Because the minute you say big government, that phrase to Americans, the hair on the back of their neck goes up. They just can't help it. You know, you say unions, for many Americans, hair in the back of their neck goes up. And, you know, this is just part of our political culture. It's who we are. We don't do these things. It's embedded in our language. So, but wait, I mean, just one more thing. Now, even if you could get rid of that problem, the language problem, and you could find suitably neutral terms that Americans would accept, there's still kind of this general notion, you know, that we're the land of liberty and we don't do this. This just isn't the way we do things. Who cares about happiness? It's just not us. I mean, lots of nations have political customs, and this is one of ours. And it's just never going to work. We'll never go for it.
I'm with you. I think there's two things there. The second part, you just said in passing, who cares about happiness? That's not us. I don't think that is really part of the American.
I don't know. I can tell you weren't raised a Lutheran in Kansas. But let me tell you what. Do not care about happiness. So,
well, fair enough. But Thomas Jefferson did.
He did, yeah.
And I grew up reading the Declaration of Independence, and I think the idea of the pursuit of happiness is, you know, every school kid in America has that burned into his brain for life. So I think Americans do care about happiness. But you're absolutely right about the wider point that you're making is big government, however you want to call it, it is in some sense an infringement on this sort of rugged individualist whole free market ideal. This is not who Americans are. This is socialistic or communistic or whatever you want to call it.
I would call it un-American. I mean,
un-American, exactly.
Un-American is what it is. It's
perfect.
Not American.
Exactly. And my response is a very simple one, and this is sort of what I'm working on here in the Netherlands at the Roosevelt Study Center, which is devoted to a European library for the papers of FDR, is that this is exactly the arguments that were made about the New Deal, which everyone now accepts, and there's practically no one who wants to, get rid of Social Security and Medicare and so on. These are or with 40-hour work week and so on. These are all just embedded within the American psyche, and the same arguments were made about them that they're un-American, they're socialists, they're just not what we do, as you put it. We fought that battle before. We may fight it again if the Democratic Party finds the will to do. It does remind me of Edmund Burke in the sense of clinging to tradition and a sort of national identity. But I think Americans more than anything else are pragmatists. You know, if you think about American political philosophy, especially in the 20th century, it's all pragmatism, and we're not ideologues. We're not a country of we Americans want to get things done. Mm-hmm. Right? We want to live in a world in which people are happy, in which we live in a world in which we're safe from crime and the other pathologies which come from deprivation and so on that the welfare state helps create. I think if people thought could be convinced that big government will create a world in which everyone is better off, that Americans would be open to that argument if it's articulated to them in an intelligent way, which
I'm just required. Yeah. I'm reminded that, you know, people misread Burke all the time. I'm a big fan of Burke. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they misread is he said, don't change anything. But what he actually said was, he said, yeah, obviously things are going to need to be changed. But the trick is to do it slowly. And while you change them, call them old.
Yeah, that sounds like Burke.
Yeah.
I'm a fan, right? Too. Yeah.
You know, definitely don't say you're doing something brand new. People won't like that. Call them old and, you know, try to get, this is an American tradition to do this. You know, that's, and that might work, you know. But, I mean, I think the pragmatic Burkean response is if you go too quickly, people are going to really bridle against this and it's going to cause more harm than good. I don't see any evidence of that. But that's what.
Well, but even if that were true, I mean, we're talking about we're not talking about reinventing the wheel or some radical departure in the world in which we live. We're just talking about marginal changes in existing programs. Yeah. So, you know, you want to create a bigger welfare state. You know, I know Americans hate the word welfare state too. Yeah. Social safety net, use that word better. Or, you know, whatever it is you want to do, you want to create greater protections for workers in the workplace. Well, you know, we have OSHA. We understand what these things are. Stiffening them a little bit, making them progressively a little better, and creating you know, more opportunities for labor unions here and there. Just, you know, we're not, again, talking about a radical transformation of society necessarily. We're talking about just moving along a path which takes us, you know, the more we move towards sort of a New Deal ideal as opposed to a Tea Party ideal, according to my research, we're going to end up with happier people.
Mm-hmm. 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 I see. Yeah, sure. Okay. So let's go on to a third, and this is my final shadow conservative objection. I don't know if it's an objection, but thing to think about. And this one, so the first one was pragmatic. The second one had to do with American political tradition and it's sort of the way in which this might or might not fit with it. The third one is even more global than that. And it says, it's basically a moral objection. And that is that people have the right not to have their stuff taken by the government, and as a matter of paternalism, it is not healthy for people to have things given to them. It turns them into something they should not be. They don't become fully articulated humans when you just start giving them stuff. So it is morally wrong to do these things. And it doesn't matter whether it makes them happy or not. You know, again, you could hear somebody in a kind of parody argument saying you could give them soma and they'd be happy.
Right.
But we're not going to do that, right? So anyway.
Well, I hope not. I see your point, and it's certainly a reasonable point and a good one. But I guess, you know, let me respond. The first point is, you know, people have a right not to have stuff taken from them. Well, I mean, that primarily means people have a right not to be taxed. And obviously, you know, we don't have a right not to be taxed. We are taxed. It's just a question. Everyone agrees with that. It's just a question of how much are we going to be taxed, and more importantly, who is going to be taxed. And so, you know, to pay for, say, to make Social Security solvent for the next 50 years, all you'd have to do is eliminate the cap on the amount of money that people have for which they're taxed under Social Security. So right now it's something like $110,000. Eliminate the cap, the higher people making more money would pay more taxes, right? And suddenly Social Security is fixed. So, you know, also, I guess on the idea that we don't have a right to have stuff taken from us, if you read Jefferson, you know, he enumerates, you know, some of our natural rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He doesn't include in their property as a one of our natural rights. He doesn't include a market economy as one of our natural rights. He, in fact, has, you know, famously changed Locke's characterization of life, liberty, and estates, meaning wealth, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So he's almost excluding in the founding document of our country, really, this idea that you have some sort of absolute right not to participate in society.
That's because he was a Freemason. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was a lot of things, but yeah. So, you know, I think, going back to the whole social contract tradition is that if you live in a society, you have to contribute to the maintenance of that society.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, just on giving people things, most people, you know, I'd say two things. We give people lots of stuff without thinking of it as a giveaway. We give children an education. We give people who are being attacked by thugs on the street police protection. You know, we give things to people who we view as members of society who are deserving to receive them. In Western Europe, a lot of people have the view that, you know, if you've lost, if you don't have a job through no fault of your own, you have a right to receive benefits from society until you can find such a job, right? That children are a asset of society, and that in many West European countries, you receive a what's called a family allowance, and everybody, regardless of income, gets a check from the government for a certain amount of money per child. And you know, if that's giving people stuff, you know, count me in.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I think those are the kinds of things that we need to be giving people. And as we extend the kinds of things that we think people deserve because they're members of society, you know, I think we make the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that's, you know, I can agree with most of that. I can. Again, these aren't positions which I necessarily hold. I just thought them up as somebody who was, you know, these are reasonable counter arguments.
No, I think they're entirely reasonable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But I mean, I think the debate about these things is actually quite healthy in the United States. And I would say that, I mean, I like the subtitle of your book, How Voters' Choices Determine the Quality of Life. I think Americans are deciding now, and they're pretty much deciding very slowly to move in this direction.
Yeah, that seems to be the trend. I think it is slow, and it's not going to be, you know, without bumps in the road. But that seems to be the direction in which things are moving. And in that sense, we're simply catching up, you know, to the rest of the Western world.
Yes, you can't put it that way and make it fly.
No, that's true.
Cannot put it like that.
We can't be more like Europe.
No, we have to be, you know, reviving something that the founding fathers taught us. That'll get done, definitely. You know,
charity. No, you're right.
It's one of the, you know, great sort of principles of our founding fathers. We have to bring it to life in a social welfare program. That's something I can get behind because it's American with a capital A.
Count me in.
Yeah, count me in too. That's good. I have a couple other questions. One is, I think we exchanged. There may have been an email exchange with this. I don't know, but was it hard to get this book published?
I'm sorry. Say again.
Was it hard to get this book published? In other words, I mentioned in the reviews, that is not only the reviews that have come out in sort of magazines and such, but also when they sent it out to be reviewed by your colleagues. Because, you know, if somebody read this book unsensitively, let's put it that way, or just with sort of blinders on, they would say, well, this is just leftist pap.
Well, I like to think that it's not leftist.
Well, it isn't. That's what I'm saying. It isn't. I'm saying if you looked at the book, you could think, oh, well, no, it's no way. This is not going to – yeah.
Well, one of the advantages of the peer reviewed university publishing process is that, relatively speaking, standards of you know, professionalism apply. So, you can't make just simply ideological arguments, and given that you know, the book is an actual work of scholarship which conforms to scholarly standards and so on, I think the book got a fair review. It was published by Cambridge, which is arguably the leading press. It was accepted. I think Cambridge
is serious probably folks over there. They sponsor our podcast, I can tell you that. Well, no, they really are very serious folks. I wouldn't have them as a sponsor if they weren't.
Yeah.
Well, then tell me about how it's been received. I mean, by people, you know.
So far, I haven't received the kind of negative responses that I expected. I mean, the book's gotten some, you know, I've been on National Public Radio. I've been on, you know, had some things. The book has been covered in the LA Times and the Washington Post, and mm-hmm. I had some opinion pieces, and it hasn't generated the kind of vitriolic response that I might have expected, which I'm not sure what that means. I don't know whether to be encouraged or whether to think that the book is simply being ignored.
Well, you know, in a way, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I mean, in a way, when I read it, and I'm pretty conservative, I'll tell you that, the punchline, the thing I took away from the book was, it's pretty safe to reduce some of the insecurity which is inherent in markets. That really is what I got out of it. And that's it. That it's things that I was a little bit afraid of, actually I shouldn't be afraid of. It's okay to take some of the instability and insecurity out of markets and the sky won't fall.
Yeah, I mean, borrow that characterization from you. Yeah.
I mean, that's really what I got out of it. I was like, all right. It might not be so bad if we had real welfare here in the United States because other people have it and they seem to be pretty happy with it. And you know, the sky didn't fall. Because really that's what we're talking about is reducing insecurity in life. I mean, I've had periods of unemployment and periods where I didn't have insurance and these kind of things. And I can't say they made me feel really good. they just didn't. And would I have liked to have had something to fall back on? Yeah. Do I think that I should carry my own weight? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I do not like to receive help from other people. I don't want to be on welfare. I really don't. But you know, in my time of need, would I want something? Yeah. And do I know people who really benefit from these programs? I absolutely do. And I know some of them would be dead without them, at least a couple. So, you know, these global issues, like, you know, it kind of reminds me, and it reminds me a little bit of actually the gay marriage debate. You know, if you allow gay people to get married, will the sky fall? Well, we've done it now and it didn't.
Right.
You know, well, and similarly here, can you reduce some insecurity of the market and will the sky fall? Well, we've done it now and it didn't.
Yeah.
Well, okay,
exactly.
We can proceed now. Okay, we know that now. Okay, we're done. We ran the experiment. It worked. Let's go. Okay, we're done now. All right, let's move on to other things. Okay, that's really what I got out of the book. I'm like, it did change my mind about it. I'm like, okay, yeah, sure.
Well, I changed someone's mind.
Yeah, well, you know, I think my mind was kind of made up about certain things, but I was concerned about this issue about whether, you know, if you really transfer a lot of income or create these huge programs, that, you know, will it do something to people's character? Will it diminish economic growth? You know, what will happen to American political tradition? Is it the slippery slope to socialism? And, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it isn't.
Well, it doesn't seem to be.
Yeah. I mean. Yeah, it isn't any of those things. So that's why I say I really like that part of the book, because it is, you do try to be neutral. I mean, it's hard, but you do a good job of it. You know, you give the evidence and like, this is the evidence, and, you know, make it what you want.
Thank you. I did try to be respectful of, you know, the conservative point of view, which I'm, you know, not personally sympathetic to politically, but which intellectually I'm very interested in. I mean, there are compelling, the conservative view of the world, I think, is a compelling one, and one that we have to take seriously.
Well, see, and that's why I think I would say the same thing about myself, is I'm not particularly, I guess, you know, sort of sympathetic to most liberal politics. But I am very interested in what people who are liberal have to say. And if they show me something that's true that I didn't know before, I'm not going to say, I don't like it because they're liberal. That's dumb.
Right.
So,
exactly.
And, you know, I read this book. And I'm like, oh, I just learned something. There we go. So we can proceed now. That's something I don't have to worry about anymore. So anyway, Ben, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been really fun talking to you. And let me close the interview by asking you our traditional final question. That is, what are you working on now?
I'm doing two things. One is an entirely fun project, which is years ago I wrote a book on Zen. I'm writing a follow-up to that, which I'm just getting started on in my free time.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing I'm working on is a follow-up to the book we've just been talking about, which is a little more historical in nature. I alluded to it a moment ago. One of the reasons I'm here at the Roosevelt Study Center is I'm going back and doing a comparison of political opposition to the New Deal, the arguments made for and against it, to this arguments being made now, you know, for and against Obamacare and for and against Tea Party mm-hmm. policies and austerity and so on, and trying to look at the similarities and the differences between the public debate that took place during those two times.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck on that project. I hope we can have you on again.
Well, thank you very much. I look forward to that.
So let me tell everybody that we've been talking to Ben Radcliffe about his terrific book, The Political Economy of Human Happiness, How Voters' Choices Determine the Quality of Life, that I loved, even though I didn't want to love it.
The highest compliment.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I think you should go read it. So let me say first, Ben, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
All right. And let me tell everybody who listens to this podcast, thank you as well for listening to the New Books Network. And I hope that you are back with us next week. Bye-bye.